He can be trusted, and I can't, Fred said.
I was thinking more about the crew, Miller said. Holden's got a small bunch, and they do what he says. They think he's righteous, so they are too.
My people follow me, Fred said. Miller's grin was weary and unassailable.
There's a lot of people in the OPA, he said.
The stakes are too high, Fred said.
You're kind of in the wrong career for safe, Miller said. I'm not saying it's a great plan, just you won't get a better one.
Fred's slitted eyes glittered with equal parts frustration and rage. His jaw worked silently for a moment before he spoke.
Captain Holden, I'm disappointed with your lack of trust after all I've done for you and yours.
If the human race still exists a month from now, I'll apologize, Holden said.
Get your crew out to Eros before I change my mind.
Holden rose, nodded to Fred, and left. Naomi walked at his side.
Wow, that was close, she said under her breath.
Once they'd left the office, Holden said, I think Fred was half a second from ordering Miller to shoot me.
Miller's on our side. Haven't you figured that out yet?
Chapter 46. Miller. Miller had known, when he'd taken Holden's side against his new boss, that there were going to be consequences. His position with Fred and the OPA was tenuous to start with, and pointing out that Holden and his crew were not only more dedicated but also more trustworthy than Fred's people wasn't the thing you did when you were kissing up. That it was the truth only made it worse. He'd expected some kind of payback. He would have been naive not to.
Rise up, O men of God, in one united throng, the resistors sang. Bring in the days of brotherhood, and end the night of wrong.
Miller took off his hat and ran fingers through his thinning hair. It wasn't going to be a good day. The interior of the Nauvoo showed more patchwork and process than its hull suggested. 2 kilometers long, its designers had built it as more than a huge ship. The great levels stacked one atop the other. Alloy girders worked organically with what would have been pastoral meadows. The structure echoed the greatest cathedrals of Earth and Mars, rising up through empty air and giving both thrust gravity stability and glory to God. It was still metal bones and woven agricultural substrate, but Miller could see where it was all heading. A generation ship was a statement of overarching ambition and utter faith. The Mormons had known that. They'd embraced it. They'd constructed a ship that was prayer and piety and celebration all at the same time. The Nauvoo would be the greatest temple mankind had ever built. It would shepherd its crew through the uncrossable gulfs of interstellar space, humanity's best hope of reaching the stars. Or it would have been, if not for him.
You want us to gas them, Pampa?
Diogo asked. Miller considered the resistors. At a guess, there might have been 200 of them strung in linked chains across the access paths and engineering ducts. Transport lifts and industrial Waldos stood idle, their displays dark, their batteries shorted.
Yeah, probably should, Miller sighed.
The security team, his security team, numbered fewer than 36. Men and women more unified by the OPA-issued armbands than by their training, experience, loyalties, or politics. If the Mormons had chosen violence, it would have been a bloodbath. If they'd put on environment suits, the protest would have lasted hours, days possibly. Instead, Diogo gave the signal, and 3 minutes later, four small comets arced out into the null G space, wavering on their tails of NNLP alpha and tetrahydrocannabinol. It was the kindest, gentlest riot control device in the arsenal. Any of the protesters with compromised lungs could still be in trouble, but within half an hour, all of them would be relaxed into near stupor and high as a kite. NNLPA and THC wasn't a combination Miller had ever used on Ceres. If they'd tried to stock it, it would have been stolen for office parties. He tried to take some comfort in the thought, as if it would make up for the lifetimes of dreams and labor he was taking away. Beside him, Diogo laughed. It took them 3 hours to make the primary sweep of the ship, and another 5 to hunt down all the stowaways huddled in ducts and secure rooms, waiting to make their presence known at the last minute and sabotage the mission. As those were hauled weeping off the ship, Miller wondered whether he'd just saved their lives. If all he'd done with his life was keep Fred Johnson from deciding whether to let a handful of innocent people die with the Nauvoo, or risk keeping Eros around for the inner planets, that wasn't so bad. As soon as Miller gave the word, the OPA tech team moved into action, re-engaging the Waldos and transports, fixing the 100 small acts of sabotage that would have kept the Nauvoo's engines from firing, clearing out equipment they wanted to save. Miller watched industrial lifts big enough to house a family of 5 shift crate after crate, moving out things that had only recently been moved in. The docks were as busy as Ceres at midshift. Miller half expected to see his old cohorts wandering among the stevedores and lift tubes, keeping what passed for the peace. In the quiet moments, he set his hand terminal to the Eros feed. Back when he'd been a kid, there had been a performance artist making the rounds. Gila Soromaya, her name was. As he recalled, she'd intentionally corrupted data storage devices and then put the data stream through her music kit. She'd gotten into trouble when some of the proprietary code of the storage device software got incorporated into her music and posted. Miller hadn't been a sophisticate. He'd figured another nutcase artist had to get a real job, and the universe could only be a better place. Listening to the Eros feed, radio-free Eros, he called it, he thought maybe he'd been a little rough on old Gila. The squeaks and cross-chatter, the flow of empty noise punctuated by voices, were eerie and compelling. Just like the broken data stream, it was the music of corruption. Asciugare il pus e che possano sentirsi meglio. Yamina nosivat kuolesta, ya halventa kotalo pakota minut yasiskoni. Do what you have to. He listened to the feed for hours, picking out voices. Once the whole thing had fluttered, cutting in and out like a piece of equipment on the edge of failure. Only after it had resumed did Miller wonder if the stutters of quiet had been Morse code. He leaned against the bulkhead, the overwhelming mass of the Nauvoo towering above him. The ship only half-born, and already marked for sacrifice. Julie sat beside him, looking up. Her hair floated around her face. Her eyes never stopped smiling. Whatever trick of the imagination had kept his own internal Juliet Andromeda Mao from coming back to him as her corpse, he thanked it. It would have been something, wouldn't it? She said, flying through vacuum without a suit, sleeping for 100 years and waking up in the light of a different sun. I didn't shoot that fucker fast enough, Miller said aloud.
He could have given us the stars.
A new voice broke in, a human voice shaking with rage.
Antichrist!
Miller blinked, returning to reality, and thumbed off the Eros feed. A prisoner transport wound its lazy way through the dock, a dozen Mormon technicians bound to its restraint poles. One was a young man with a pocked face and hatred in his eyes. He was staring at Miller.
You're the Antichrist, you vile excuse for a human. God knows you. He'll remember you.
Miller tipped his hat as the prisoners ambled by.
Stars are better off without us, he said,
but too softly for anyone but Julie to hear. A dozen tugs flew before the Nauvoo, the web of nanotubule tethers invisible at this distance. All Miller saw was the great behemoth, as much a part of Tycho Station as the bulkheads and air, shift in its bed, shrug, and begin to move. The tug's drive flares lit the interior space of the station, flickering in their perfectly choreographed duties like Christmas lights, and a nearly subliminal shudder passed through the deep, steel bones of Tycho. In 8 hours, the Nauvoo would be far enough out that the great engines could be brought online without endangering the station with their exhaust plume. It might be more than 2 weeks after that, before it reached Eros. Miller would beat it there by 80 hours.
Oi, Pampa, Diogo said. Done, done?
Yeah, Miller said with a sigh. I'm ready. Let's get everyone together.
The boy grinned. In the hours since the commandeering of the Nauvoo, Diogo had added bright red plastic decorations to three of his front teeth. It was apparently deeply meaningful in the youth culture of Tycho Station, and signified prowess, possibly sexual. Miller felt a moment's relief that he wasn't hot bunking at the boy's place anymore. Now that he was running security ops for the OPA, the irregular nature of the group was clearer to him than ever. There had been a time when he thought the OPA might be something that could take on Earth or Mars when it came to real war. Certainly they had more money and resources than he'd thought. They had Fred Johnson. They had Ceres now, for as long as they could hold it. They'd taken on Thoth Station, and won. And yet, the same kids he'd gone on the assault with had been working crowd control at the Nauvoo, and more than half of them would be on the demolition ship when it left for Eros. It was the thing that Havelock would never understand. For that matter, it was the thing Holden would never understand. Maybe no one who had lived with the certainty and support of a natural atmosphere would ever completely accept the power and fragility of a society based in doing what needed doing, in becoming fast and flexible the way the OPA had, in becoming articulated. If Fred couldn't build himself a peace treaty, the OPA would never win against the discipline and unity of an interplanet navy. But they would also never lose. War without end. Well, what was history, if not that? And how would having the stars change anything? As he walked to his apartment, he opened a channel request on his hand terminal. Fred Johnson appeared, looking tired but alert.
Miller, he said. We're getting ready to ship out if the ordnance is ready.
It's loading now, Fred replied. Enough fissionable material to keep the surface of Eros unapproachable for years.
Be careful with it. If one of your boys goes down for a smoke in the wrong place, we aren't going to be able to replace the mines. Not in time. Not, you'll all be dead.
The weapons were precious, not the people.
Yeah. I'll watch it, Miller said. The Rocinante's already on its way.
That wasn't something Miller needed to know. So there was some other reason Fred had mentioned it. His carefully neutral tone made it something like an accusation. the only controlled sample of protomolecule had left Fred's sphere of influence.
"We'll get out there to meet her in plenty of time to keep anybody off Eros," Miller said. "Shouldn't be a problem."
On the tiny screen, it was hard to tell how genuine Fred's smile was.
"I hope your friends are really up for this," he said.
Miller felt something odd, a little hollowness just below his breastbone.
"They aren't my friends," he said, keeping his tone of voice light.
"No?"
"I don't exactly have friends. It's more I've got a lot of people I used to work with," he said.
"You put a lot of faith in Holden,"
Fred said, making it almost a question, a challenge at least. Miller smiled, knowing that Fred would be just as unsure if his was genuine.
"Not faith, judgment," he said.
Fred coughed out a laugh.
"And that's why you don't have friends, friend."
"Part of it," Miller said. There was nothing more to say. Miller dropped the connection. He was almost at his hole anyway. It was nothing much. An anonymous cube on the station, with even less personality to it than his place back on Ceres. He sat on his bunk, checked his terminal for the status of the demolition ship. He knew that he should just go up to the docks. Diogo and the others were assembling, and while it wasn't likely that the drug haze of the pre-mission parties would allow them all to arrive on time, it was at least possible. He didn't even have that excuse. Julie sat in the space behind his eyes. Her legs were folded under her. She was beautiful. She'd been like Fred and Holden and Havelock. Someone born in a gravity well who came to the belt by choice. She'd died for her choice. She'd come looking for help and killed Eros by doing it. If she'd stayed there, on that ghost ship. She tilted her head, her hair swinging against the spin gravity. There was a question in her eyes. She was right, of course. It would have slowed things down, maybe. It wouldn't have stopped them. Protogen and Dresden would have found her eventually. Would have found it. Or gone back and dug up a fresh sample. Nothing would have stopped them. And he knew the way he knew he was himself, that Julie wasn't like the others. That she'd understood the belt and belters and the need to push on. If not for the stars, at least close to them. The luxury available to her was something Miller had never experienced and never would. But she'd turned away. She'd come out here, and stayed even when they were going to sell her racing pinnace. Her childhood, her pride. That was why he loved her. When Miller reached the dock, it was clear something had happened. It was in the way the dock workers held themselves, and the looks, half amusement and half pleasure, on their faces. Miller signed in and crawled through the awkward Odino Gouch-style airlock. 70 years out of date and hardly larger than a torpedo tube, into the cramped crew area of the Talbot Leeds. The ship looked like it had been welded together from two smaller ships, without particular concern for design. The acceleration couches were stacked three deep. The air smelled of old sweat and hot metal. Someone had been smoking marijuana recently enough that the filters hadn't cleared it out yet. Diogo was there, along with a half dozen others. They all wore different uniforms, but they also all had the OPA armband.
"Oi, Pampa! Kept top bunker, dear?"
"Thanks," Miller said. "I appreciate that."
13 days. He was going to spend 13 days sharing this tiny space with the demolitions crew. 13 days pressed into these couches with megatons of fission mines in the ship's hold. And yet, the others were all smiling. Miller hauled himself up to the acceleration couch Diogo had saved for him and pointed to the others with his chin.
Someone have a birthday?
Diogo gave an elaborate shrug.
Why is everyone in such a good fucking mood? Miller said, more sharply than he'd intended.
Diogo took no offense. He smiled his great red and white teeth.
Aldi nix?
No, I haven't heard, or I wouldn't be asking, Miller said.
Mars did the right thing, Diogo said. Got the feed off Eros. Put two and two, and...
The boy slammed a fist into his open palm. Miller tried to parse what he was saying. They'd attacked Eros? They'd taken on Protogen?
Ah, Protogen.
Protogen and Mars. Miller nodded.
The Phoebe science station, he said. Mars quarantined it.
Fuck that, Pampa. Autoclaved it, them. Moon is gone. Dropped enough nukes on it to split it subatomic.
They better have, Miller thought. It wasn't a big moon.
If Mars had really destroyed it, and there was any protomolecule left on a hunk of ejecta...
Tu sabes? Diogo said. They're on our side now. They get it. Mars-OPA Alliance.
You don't really think that, Miller said.
Nah,
Diogo said, just as pleased with himself in admitting that the hope was fragile, at best, and probably false.
But don't hurt to dream, Kano.
You don't think?
Miller said, and lay back. The acceleration gel was too stiff to conform to his body at the dock's 1/3 G, but it wasn't uncomfortable. He checked the news on his hand terminal, and indeed someone in the Martian Navy had made a judgment call. It was a lot of ordnance to use, especially in the middle of a shooting war, but they'd expended it. Saturn had one fewer moon, one more tiny, unformed, filamentous ring, if there was even enough matter left from the detonations to form that. It looked to Miller's unpracticed eye as if the explosions had been designed to drop debris into the protective and crushing gravity of the gas giant. It was foolish to think it meant the Martian government wouldn't want samples of the protomolecule. It was naive to pretend that any organization of that size and complexity was unequivocal about anything, much less something as dangerous and transforming as this. But still, perhaps it was enough just knowing that someone on the other side of the political and military divide had seen the same evidence they had seen, and drawn the same conclusions. Maybe it left room for hope. He switched his hand terminal back to the Eros feed. A strong, throbbing sound danced below a cascade of noise. Voices rose and fell, and rose again. Data streams spewed into one another, and the pattern recognition servers burned every spare cycle, making something from the resultant mess. Julie took his hand. The dream so convincing he could almost pretend he felt it.
You belong with me, she said.
As soon as it's over, he thought.
It was true he kept pushing back the endpoint of the case. First, find Julie, then avenge her, and now destroy the project that had claimed her life. But after that was accomplished, he could let go. He just had this one last thing he needed to do. 20 minutes later, the klaxon sounded. 30 minutes later, the engines kicked on, pressing him into the acceleration gel at a joint-crushing high-G burn for 13 days, with 1G breaks for biological function every 4 hours. And when they were done, the half-trained, jack-of-all-trades crew would be handling nuclear mines capable of annihilating them if they screwed it up. But at least Julie would be there. Not really, but still. It didn't hurt to dream.
Chapter 47. Holden. Even the wet, cellulose taste of reconstituted artificial scrambled eggs was not enough to ruin Holden's warm, self-satisfied glow. He shoveled the faux eggs into his mouth, trying not to grin. Sitting at his left around the galley table, Amos ate with lip-smacking enthusiasm. To Holden's right, Alex pushed the limp eggs around on his plate with a piece of equally fake toast. Across the table, Naomi sipped a cup of tea and looked at him from under her hair. He stifled the urge to wink at her. They'd talked about how to break the news to the crew, but hadn't come to any consensus. Holden hated to hide anything. Keeping it secret made it seem dirty or shameful. His parents had raised him to believe that sex was something you did in private, not because it was embarrassing, but because it was intimate. With five fathers and three mothers, the sleeping arrangements were always complex at his house, but the discussions about who was bedding with whom were never hidden from him. It left him with a strong aversion to hiding his own activities. Naomi, on the other hand, thought they shouldn't do anything to upset the fragile equilibrium they'd found, and Holden trusted her instincts. She had an insight into group dynamics that he often lacked, so for now he was following her lead. Besides, it would have felt like boasting, and that would have been rude. Keeping his voice neutral and professional, he said, "Naomi, can you pass the pepper?" Amos's head snapped up, and he dropped his fork on the table with a loud clatter.
"Holy shit, you guys are doing it!"
Holden said, "What?"
"Something's been screwy ever since we got back on the Rosie, but I couldn't figure. But that's it! You guys are finally playing hide the weasel."
Holden blinked twice at the big mechanic, unsure of what to say. He glanced at Naomi for support, but her head was down, and her hair completely covered her face. Her shoulders were shaking in silent laughter.
"Jesus, Cap," Amos said, a grin on his wide face. "It fucking took you long enough. If she'd been throwing herself at me like that, I'd have been neck deep in that shit."
Alex said, looking shocked enough that it was clear he hadn't shared Amos's insights.
"Wow."
Naomi stopped laughing and wiped tears away from the corners of her eyes.
"Busted," she said.
"Look, guys, it's important that you know this doesn't affect our..." Holden said, but Amos cut him off with a snort.
"Hey, Alex," Amos said.
"Yo,"
Alex replied.
"Exo boning the captain going to make you a really shitty pilot?"
"Don't believe it will,"
Alex said with a grin, exaggerating his drawl.
"And oddly enough, I don't feel the need to be a lousy mechanic."
Holden tried again. "I think it's important that..."
"Captain?"
Amos continued, ignoring him.
"Consider that no one gives a fuck. It won't stop us from doing our jobs and just enjoy it, since we'll probably all be dead in a few days anyway."
Naomi started laughing again.
"Fine," she said. "I mean, everyone knows I'm only doing it to get a promotion. Oh, wait, right, already the second in command. Hey, can I be captain now?"
"No," Holden said, laughing. "It's a shit job. I'd never ask you to do it." Naomi grinned and shrugged. "See? I'm not always right." Holden glanced at Alex, who was looking at him with genuine affection, clearly happy about the idea of him and Naomi together. Everything seemed right. Eros spun like a potato-shaped top, its thick skin of rock hiding the horrors inside. Alex brought them in close to do a thorough scan of the station.
The asteroid swelled on Holden's screen until it looked close enough to touch. At the other op station, Naomi swept the surface with LADAR, looking for anything that might pose a danger to the Tycho freighter crews still a few days behind. On Holden's tactical display, the UNN science ship continued to flare in a braking maneuver toward Eros, its escort right beside it.
"Still not talking, huh?" Holden asked. Naomi shook her head, then tapped on her screen and sent the comms monitoring information to his workstation.
"Nope," she said. "But they see us. They've been bouncing radar off us for a couple hours now."
Holden tapped his fingers on the arm of his chair and thought about the choices. It was possible that the hull modifications Tycho had made to the Rossi were fooling the Earth Corvette's recognition software. They might just ignore the Rossi, thinking she was a belter gas runner that happened to be hanging around. But the Rossi was running without a transponder, which made her illegal no matter what hull configuration she was showing. That the Corvette wasn't trying to warn off a ship that was running dark made him nervous. The Belt and the inner planets were in a shooting war. A belter ship with no identification was hanging around Eros while two Earth ships flew toward it. No way any captain with half a brain would just ignore them. The Corvette's silence meant something else.
"Naomi, I have a feeling that Corvette is going to try and blow us up," Holden said with a sigh.
"It's what I'd do," she replied.
Holden tapped one last complicated rhythm on his chair, then put his headset on.
"All right, I guess I make the first overture then," he said. Not wishing to make their conversation public, Holden targeted the Earther Corvette with a Rocinante's laser array and signaled a generic link-up request. After a few seconds, the link-established light went green, and his earplugs began to hiss with faint background static. Holden waited, but the UN ship offered no greeting. They wanted him to speak first. He flicked off his mic, switching to the ship-wide comm.
"Alex, get us moving. 1G for now. If I can't bluff this guy, it'll be a shooting match. Be ready to open her up."
"Roger," drawled Alex. "Going on the juice, just in case."
Holden glanced over at Naomi's station, but she'd already switched to her tactical screen and had the Rossi plotting firing solutions and jamming tactics on the two approaching ships. Naomi had been in only one battle, but she was reacting now like a seasoned veteran. He smiled at her back, then turned around before she had time to realize he was staring.
"Amos," he said. "Lock down and shipshape down here, Cap. The Rossi's pawing at the turf. Let's go kick some ass."
"Let's hope we don't have to," Holden thought. He turned his mic back on.
"This is Captain James Holden of the Rocinante calling the captain of the approaching United Nations Navy Corvette. Call sign unknown. Please respond." There was a static-filled pause, followed by,
"Rocinante, leave our flight path immediately. If you do not begin moving away from Eros at best possible speed, you will be fired upon."
The voice was young, an aging Corvette with the tedious task of following an asteroid mapping ship around wouldn't be a much sought-after command. The captain was probably a lieutenant with patrons or prospects. He'd be inexperienced, but he might see a confrontation as an opportunity to prove himself to his superiors, and that made the next few moments treacherous to navigate.
"Sorry," said Holden. "Still don't know your call sign or your name, but I can't do what you want. In fact, I can't let anyone land on Eros. I'm going to need you to stop approaching the station."
"Rocinante, I don't think you—" Holden took control of the Rossi's targeting system and began painting the approaching Corvette with its targeting laser.
"Let me explain what's happening here," he said. "Right now, You're looking at your sensors, and you're seeing what looks like a thrown-together gas freighter that's giving your ship recognition software fits. And all of a sudden, meaning right now, it's painting you with a state-of-the-art target acquisition system. We don't lie. I know that's what's happening. So here's the deal. Despite how it looks, my ship is newer, faster, tougher, and better armed than yours. The only way for me to really prove that is to open fire, and I'm hoping not to do that.
Are you threatening me, Rocinante?
The young voice on Holden's headset said, its tone hitting just the right notes of arrogance and disbelief.
You? No, said Holden. I'm threatening the big, fat, slow-moving, and unarmed ship you're supposed to be protecting. You keep flying toward Eros, and I will unload everything I've got at it. I guarantee we will blow that flying science lab out of the sky. Now, it's possible you might get us while we do it, but by then your mission is screwed anyway, right?
The line went silent again. Only the hiss of background radiation letting him know his headset hadn't died. When his answer came, it came on the ship-wide comms. Alex said,
They're stopping, Captain. They just started hard braking. Tracking says they'll be relative stopped about 2 million clicks out. Want me to keep flying toward him?
No, bring us back to our stationary position over Eros, Holden replied.
Roger that.
Naomi, Holden said, spinning his chair around to face her.
Are they doing anything else?
Not that I can see through the clutter of their exhaust, but they could be tight-beaming messages the other direction and we'd never know, she said.
Holden flipped the ship-wide comm off. He scratched his head for a minute, then unbuckled his restraints.
Well, we stopped them for now. I'm going to hit the head and then grab a drink. Want anything?
He's not wrong, you know, Naomi said later that night. Holden was floating in zero-G on the ops deck, his station a few feet away. He turned down the deck lights, and the cabin was as dim as a moonlit night. Alex and Amos were sleeping two decks below. They might as well have been a million light-years away. Naomi was floating near her own station, 2 meters away, her hair unbound and drifting around her like a black cloud. The panel behind her lit her face in profile. The long forehead, flat nose, large lips. He could tell that her eyes were closed. He felt like they were the only two people in the universe.
Who's not wrong? He said, just to be saying something.
Miller, she replied as though it were obvious.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Naomi laughed, then swatted with one hand to rotate her body and face him in the air. Her eyes were open now, though with the panel lights behind her, they were visible only as black pools in her face.
I've been thinking about Miller, she said. I treated him badly on Tycho. Ignored him because you were angry. I owed him better than that.
Why?
He saved your life on Eros.
Holden snorted, but she kept going anyway. When you were in the Navy, she finally said, what were you supposed to do when someone went crazy on the ship? Started doing things that endangered everyone? Thinking they were talking about Miller, Holden said, you restrain him and remove him as a danger to the ship and crew. But Fred didn't. Naomi cut him off.
What if it's wartime? She said. The middle of a battle.
If he can't be easily restrained, the chief of the watch has an obligation to protect the ship and crew by whatever means necessary.
Even shooting him.
If that's the only way to do it, Holden replied.
Sure.
But it would only be in the most pressing circumstances. Naomi nodded with her hand, sending her body slowly twisting the other way. She stopped her motion with one unconscious gesture. Holden was pretty good in zero-G, but he'd never be that good. The belt is a network, Naomi said.
It's like one big distributed ship. We have nodes that make air, or water, or power, or structural materials. Those nodes may be separated by millions of kilometers of space, but that doesn't make them any less interconnected. I see where this is going, Holden said with a sigh. Dresden was a madman on the ship. Miller shot him to protect the rest of us. He gave me that speech back on Tycho. Didn't buy it then, either.
Why?
Because, Holden said, Dresden wasn't an immediate threat. He was just an evil little man in an expensive suit. He didn't have a gun in his hand or his finger on a bomb trigger. And I will never trust a man who believes he has the right to unilaterally execute people. Holden put his foot against the bulkhead and tapped off just hard enough to float a few feet closer to Naomi. Close enough to see her eyes, read her reaction to him. If that science ship starts flying toward Eros again, I will throw every torpedo we have at it, and tell myself I was protecting the rest of the solar system from what's on Eros. But I won't just start shooting at it now, on the idea that it might decide to head to Eros again. Because that's murder. What Miller did was murder. Naomi smiled at him, then grabbed his flight suit and pulled him close enough for a kiss. You might be the best person I know, but you're totally uncompromising on what you think is right. And that's what you hate about Miller.
I do?
Yes, she said. He's totally uncompromising too. But he has different ideas on how things work. You hate that. To Miller, Dresden was an active threat to the ship. Every second he stayed alive endangered everyone else around him. To Miller, it was self-defense. But he's wrong. The man was helpless. The man talked the UN Navy into giving his company state-of-the-art ships, she said. He talked his company into murdering 1.5 million people. Everything Miller said about why the protomolecule is better off with us was just as true about Dresden. How long is he in an OPA lockup before he finds the jailer who can be bought? He was a prisoner, Holden said, feeling the argument slipping away from him. He was a monster with power, access, and allies who would have paid any price to keep his science project going, Naomi said. And I'm telling you, as a Belter, Miller wasn't wrong. Holden didn't answer. He just continued to float next to Naomi, keeping himself in her orbit. Was he angrier about the killing of Dresden, or about Miller's making a decision that disagreed with him? And Miller had known. When Holden had told him to find his own ride back to Tycho, he'd seen it in the detective's sad, basset hound face. Miller had known it was coming, and he had made no attempt to fight or argue. That meant that Miller had made his choice fully cognizant of the cost and ready to pay it. That meant something. Holden wasn't sure exactly what, but something. A red telltale began flashing on the wall, and Naomi's panel woke up and began throwing data onto the screen. She pulled herself down to it, using the back of her chair, then tapped out several quick commands. Shit, she said. What is it? The corvette or science ship must have called for help, Naomi said, pointing at her screen. We've got ships on their way from all over the system. How many are coming? Holden asked, trying to get a better look at her screen. Naomi made a small sound in the back of her throat, halfway between a chuckle and a cough. At a guess, all of them.
Chapter 48. Miller. You are and you aren't, the Eros feed said through a semi-random drumming of static. You are and you aren't. You are and you aren't. The little ship shuddered and bumped. From a crash couch, One of the OPA techs called out a string of obscenities, remarkable more for inventiveness than actual rancor. Miller closed his eyes, trying to keep the micro-G adjustments of their non-standard docking from nauseating him. After days of joint-aching acceleration and an equally bruising braking routine, the small shifts and movements felt arbitrary and strange. You are. He spent some time listening to the news feeds. 3 days after they'd left Tycho, the news of Protogen's involvement with Eros broke. Amazingly, Holden hadn't been the one to do it. Since then, the corporation had gone from total denial to blaming a rogue subcontractor to claiming immunity under an Earth Defense Secret statute. It didn't sound good for them. Earth's blockade of Mars was still in place, but attention had shifted to the power struggle within Earth, and the Martian Navy had slowed its burn, giving the Earth forces a little more breathing room before any permanent decisions had to be made. It looked like they'd postponed Armageddon, for a few weeks anyway. Miller found he could take a certain joy in that. It also left him tired. More often, he listened to the voice of Eros. Sometimes he watched the video feeds, too, but usually he just listened. Over the hours and days, he began to hear, if not patterns, at least common structures. Some of the voices spooling out of the dying station were consistent, broadcasters and entertainers who were overrepresented in the audio files archives, he guessed. There seemed to be some specific tendencies in, for want of a better term, the music of it too. Hours of random, fluting static and snatched bits of phrases would give way, and Eros would latch on to some word or phrase, fixating on it with greater and greater intensity until it broke apart and the randomness poured back in. R. Aren't, Miller thought. And the ship suddenly shoved itself up, leaving Miller's stomach about half a foot from where it had been. A series of loud clanks followed, and then the brief wail of a klaxon.
Dieu, Dieu, someone shouted. Bamson vamin roja, going to fry it. Fry us toda.
There was the usual polite chuckle that the same joke had occasioned over the course of the trip, and the boy who'd made it, a pimply belter no more than 15 years old, grinned with pleasure at his own wit. If he didn't stop that shit, someone was going to beat him with a crowbar before they got back to Tycho. But Miller figured that someone wasn't him. A massive jolt forward pushed him hard into the couch, and then gravity was back. The familiar 0.3G. Maybe a little more. Except that with the airlocks pointing toward ships down, the pilot had to grapple the spinning skin of Eros's belly first. The spin gravity made what had been the ceiling the new floor. The lowest rank of couches was now the top, and while they rigged the fusion bombs to the docks, they were all going to have to climb up onto a cold, dark rock that was trying to fling them off into the vacuum. Such were the joys of sabotage. Miller suited up. After the military-grade suits of the Rosinante, the OPA's motley assortment of equipment felt like third-hand clothes. His suit smelled like someone else's body, and the Mylar faceplate had a deformation where it had cracked and been repaired. He didn't like thinking about what had happened to the poor bastard who'd been wearing it. The magnetic boots had a thick layer of corroded plastic and old mud between the plates, and a triggering mechanism so old that Miller could feel it click on and off even before he moved his foot. He had the image of the suit locking on to Eros and never letting go. The thought made him smile. "You belong with me," his own private Julie had said. It was true, and now that he was here, He felt perfectly certain that he wasn't going to leave. He'd been a cop for too long, and the idea of trying to reconnect to humanity again filled him with a presentiment of exhaustion. He was here to do the last part of his job. And then he was done.
Oi, Pampo!
I'm coming, Miller said. Hold your damn horses. It's not like the station's going anyplace.
A rainbow is a circle you can't see, can't see, can't see, Eros said in a child's sing-song voice. Miller turned down the volume of his feed. The rocky surface of the station had no particular purchase for the suits and control Waldos. Two other ships had made polar landings where there was no spin gravity to fight against, but the Coriolis would leave everyone with a subliminal nausea. Miller's team had to keep to the exposed metal plates of the dock, clinging like flies looking down into the starlit abyss. Engineering the placement of the fusion bombs wasn't trivial work. If the bombs didn't pump enough energy into the station, the surface might cool enough to give someone another chance to put a science team on it before the penumbra of the sun swallowed it and whatever parts of the Nauvoo were still clinging to it. Even with the best minds of Tycho, there was still the chance that the detonations wouldn't sync up. If the pressure waves traveling through the rock amplified in ways they hadn't anticipated, the station could crack open like an egg, spreading the protomolecule through the wide, empty track of the solar system like scattering a handful of dust. But the difference between success and disaster might be literally a question of meters. Miller crawled up the airlock and out to the station surface. The first wave of technicians were setting up resonant seismographs. The glow of the work lights and readouts the brightest thing in the universe. Miller set his boots on a wide swath of ceramic steel alloy and let the spin stretch the kinks out of his back. After days in the acceleration couch, the freedom felt euphoric. One of the techs raised her hands, the physical belter idiom that called for attention. Miller upped the suit volume.
Insecte rampant sur ma peau.
With a stab of impatience, he switched from the Eros feed to the team channel.
Got to move, a woman's voice said. Too much splashback here. We have to get to the other side of the docks.
These go on for almost 2 kilometers, Miller said.
Is, she agreed. We can unmoor and move the ship under power, or we can tow it. We've got enough lead line.
Which one's fastest? We don't have a lot of spare time here.
Towing.
Tow it then, Miller said.
Slowly, the ship rose. 20 small, crawling transport drones clinging to leads like they were hauling a great metallic zeppelin. The ship was going to stay with him, here on the station, strapped to the rock like a sacrifice to the gods. Miller walked with the crew as they crossed the wide, closed bay doors. The only sounds were the tapping of his soles as the electromagnets jolted onto the surface, and then a tick when they let go again. The only smells were of his own body and the fresh plastic of the air recycler. The metal under his feet shone like someone had cleaned it. Any dust or pebbles had been hurled away long ago. They worked fast to place the ship, arm the bombs, and fit the security codes, everyone tacitly aware of the great missile that had been the Nauvoo speeding toward them. If another ship came down and tried to disarm the trap, the ship would send synchronizing signals to all the other OPA bomb ships studding the moon's surface. 3 seconds later, the surface of Eros would be scrubbed clean. The spare air and supplies were loaded off the ship, bundled together and ready for reclamation. No reason to waste the resources. Nothing horrific crawled out of an airlock and tried to attack the crew, which made Miller's presence during the mission entirely superfluous.
Or maybe not. Maybe it was just a ride. When everything was done that could be, Miller sent the all clear, relayed through the now dead ship system. The return transport appeared slowly, a dot of light that grew gradually brighter and then spread. The null G boarding web strung out like scaffolding. At the new ship's word, Miller's team turned off their boots and fired simple maneuvering thrusters, either from their suits, or, if the suits were too old, from shared ablative evacuation shells. Miller watched them drop away.
"Call va en roll, Pampa," Diogo said from someplace.
Miller wasn't sure which of them he was at this distance.
"This tube don't sit."
"I'm not coming," Miller said.
"Sake?"
"I decided. I'm staying here."
There was a moment of silence. Miller had been waiting for this. He had the security codes. If he needed to crawl back into the shell of their old ship and lock the door behind him, he could. But he didn't want to. He'd prepared his arguments. He would only be going back to Tycho as a political pawn for Fred Johnson's negotiations. He was tired and old, in a way that years didn't describe. He'd already died on Eros once, and he wanted to be here to finish it. He'd earned that much. Diogo and the others owed it to him. He waited for the boy to react, to try to talk him out of it.
"All correct, then," Diogo said.
"Buona morte."
"Buona morte,"
Miller said, and shut off his radio. The universe was silent. The stars below him shifted slowly but perceptibly as the station he hung from spun. One of those lights was the Rocinante. Two others were the ships Holden had been sent out to stall. Miller couldn't pick them out. Julie floated beside him, her dark hair floating in the vacuum, the stars shining through her. She looked peaceful.
"If you had to do it again," she said, "if you could do it all over from the beginning."
"I wouldn't," he said.
He watched the OPA transport ship start up its engines, glowing gold and white, and pull away until it was a star again, a small one, and then lost. Miller turned and considered the dark, empty moonscape and the permanent night. He just needed to be with her for another few hours, and they would both be safe. They would all be safe. It was enough. Miller found himself smiling and weeping, the tears tracking up from his eyes and into his hair.
"It's going to be fine," Julie said.
"I know," Miller said.
He stood silently for almost an hour, then turned and made his slow, precarious way back to the sacrificed ship, down the airlock, and into the dim belly. There was enough residual atmosphere that he didn't need to sleep in his suit. He stripped naked, chose an acceleration couch, and curled up on the hard blue gel. Not 20 meters away, 5 fusion devices, powerful enough to outshine the sun, waited for a signal. Above him, everything that had once been human in Eros Station changed and reformed, pouring from one shape to another, like Hieronymus Bosch made real. And still, almost a day away, the Nauvoo, the hammer of God, hurtled toward him. Miller set his suit to play some old pop tunes he'd enjoyed when he was young, and let himself be sung to sleep. When he dreamed he'd found a tunnel at the back of his old hole on Ceres that meant he would at last, be free. His last breakfast was a hard kibble bar
and a handful of chocolate scrounged from a forgotten survival pack. He ate it with tepid recycled water that tasted of iron and rot. The signals from Eros were almost dry.